Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. We haven't heard much in this election cycle about education. Oh, everybody's all for it, but what specifically are they for? We'll see where the presidential candidates are on the issue of education and some related issues like ballooning college tuition, mounting student debt, and stagnant teacher salaries. We'll talk with NPR's education correspondent, Eric Westervelt, and with you right after this news from NPR. Good Monday afternoon. It is so great to be with you today. I'll tell you, we are starting our 21st year today. So just a quick note to say thank you, thank you, thank you so much. First, for your contributions last week, but also for the very, very many lovely ways that you found to express your appreciation for our 20 years on the air. I was blown away on Thursday when we had a big celebration. We had our little cake party, which is, you know, anytime you get a cake party in a day, that is a good thing. But I very much appreciate it. It was just a lovely, could not have been a lovelier day, and made so by your kind calls and thoughts. So thank you for that. Thank you very, very much. We are continuing, by the way, this week, our look at issues attendant to the presidential campaign. Well, attendant might not be quite the right word. We're talking about issues that aren't also getting a lot of attention in the course of the campaign. So we'll do that as we are once a week leading right up to Election Day, which is blessedly coming fast here. So we'll do that this week. Tomorrow, we're going to be looking at redistricting. This is certainly something that has affected the shape of districts in Virginia. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. Then on Wednesday, we head over to the 4th Congressional District. We'll be having our candidate conversations. As you know, there is more than the presidential election on the ballot on November 8th. And again, if you are confused about where you vote, and in any case, you should just always recheck this. You want to check with the State Board of Elections website at sbe.virginia.gov, because if you just plug your address in there, it'll tell you exactly where to vote. You may find yourself newly in the 4th District. If you are, you will want to join us on Wednesday. We'll be talking with the candidates for the 4th Congressional District. And then on Thursday, we take a look at the art of aging. And man, it is an art and a science. So we'll talk about that on Thursday this week. So lots going on this week, and we're glad to have you in the conversation. A little later in the program, we'll talk with Dave Ress, who is a senior reporter at the Daily Press. And he's been taking a look at some of the issues around education in Virginia and what's going on there. And education is indeed our topic today. It's our focus topic for these weekly shows that we're doing leading up to the presidential race on November 8th. And we're glad to be talking about education today because, honestly, there hasn't been as much conversation as I suspect those who are really concerned about this would like there to be. We're glad to have Eric Westervelt with us today. He is the education and education correspondent for NPR. Eric, nice to have you with us today.
Kathy, it's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. You've been writing about certainly not only the candidates and their positions on this, but you've also been writing about some of the overarching about some of the overarching issues that are hoped to be addressed by the presidential candidates. And the one you've written about very recently that strikes me every time I go out in the community and talk with people is the looming, well, I would say present, teacher shortage. This group of teachers who have many, many years of education who are beginning to retire, and the nation's apparent inability, to keep younger teachers in the game longer. What does your reporting reveal on that? And do you have the sense that the presidential candidates are responding to that?
Yeah, I mean, our national attrition rate for teachers is just a little over 8%. That's a lot higher than other industrialized nations, some cases other countries are at 3 or 4%. And this isn't just the normal retirement cycle. So we've got, you know, thousands of teachers leaving the profession every year. And some folks are saying, you know, we've got to address that critically because there are long-term shortages that have been around for a long time in especially special education, science, math, and English language learner classes. So those are key areas where the shortages are continuing. It is regional. Some states do not have the shortages, but it's an issue that's grown in importance. Teachers leaving for a variety of reasons, but some key ones certainly include pay and working conditions. And the latter, working conditions, can include really feeling like they don't have the voice within the class, within the school that they would like. There's others, teachers we talked to, that have said, you know, we feel like there's too much bureaucracy. There is over-testing. We are the classic criticism, teaching to the test. It's not fun anymore. The kids aren't learning the way we'd hoped. They're getting kind of burned out. I feel like they're getting pressure and squeezed. And, you know, in some ways, too many of them are leaving the profession, and that's hurting. To the second part of the question is, are the candidates addressing it? Yeah, that's absolutely not. I mean, education is arguably second only to national security in American importance. Polls always show Americans care deeply about education, yet it's gotten almost no discussion this presidential year. And in the few remaining weeks we have, you know, I kind of doubt it will get the attention. In these three presidential debates and one vice presidential debate, it's barely come up. I mean, Donald Trump talks a little bit about the Common Core and says he doesn't like it, but doesn't have any specifics about it or what he'd actually do as president. And then Secretary Clinton talks, you know, often on the stump about reducing the cost of college and a little bit about universal pre-K. But again, they're kind of talking points, and it hasn't come up in debates, and it hasn't become part of the national dialogue or discussion in a way that it should, given the pressing issues that face, you know, pre-K through higher ed education in America.
We're at 13 minutes past the hour, and that's Eric Westervelt. He's an education correspondent for NPR. I keep trying to put it all on your shoulders, Eric, but you are one of many, we should say. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers where you can join us today. And we're wondering how focused you are as you think about the candidates in the 2016 presidential election. How focused are you on education as an issue? Who do you think, as you look at these platforms, as you've been able to find them, noting they are fairly scant, what candidate, and remembering that there are more than just the major two, do you think will have a better handle on education moving forward? I'm sure we have folks in the audience today who have student debt. How closely are you watching those proposals? 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers where you can join us today. We're also glad to have Bob Pianta with us today. He's the Dean of the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. Dean Pianta, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I know that you wrote a letter, and I love this idea of thinking through what giving advice to a president about what he or she should do in the first year in office. But you've really suggested that from an education perspective, the next president should focus on equalizing educational opportunity. What do you think? What does that look like from your perspective?
Well, I think it's really important to know that the federal role in K-12 education is limited. I mean, the states and localities have the bulk of the budget and the bulk of the regulation. So, and in fact, if you look back, you know, particularly through the Obama administration, where there was a real effort to increase the federal role, evaluating teacher effectiveness, much more of an emphasis on testing kids and the use of test scores for all sorts of purposes and accountability. You know, we saw a very, very strong pushback against that federal role in the reauthorization or the attempt to reauthorize No Child Left Behind. So I from my perspective, I think there's going to be very, very little that the federal government is going to be able to do to really change what what K-12 education looks like. There's a strong federal role if one wants to consider it in terms of the importance of the federal government in addressing inequality and opportunity. There's a very strong and I think well justified role in early childhood education. So Clinton has put forth a credible proposal to provide universal pre-K. We can argue whether that's a good idea or not to go universal, but there's also a very strong federal presence in early education through Head Start, and there's legislation now underway around authorizing the accountability procedures in Head Start. So my argument has been that a very aggressive federal role to provide very high quality, higher quality than we currently have, programs for poor children for a period of 2 years prior to entering the school is a reasonable way for the federal government to spend its time, effort, and dollars to address these opportunity costs and opportunity gaps.
Eric Westerveld, Bob Pienta says that Secretary Clinton has a credible plan in that regard. What is your assessment of Clinton's plan and Trump's plan based on the reporting that you've been doing? With regard to early childhood, yeah.
Sure, and I would just add to Bob's point. I mean, I agree with him that, you know, education has historically been and still remains a local and state initiative. But the federal government does, as he mentioned, specifically with at-risk students and on this sort of a civil rights equity issue, provide $15 trillion in Title I funds to help schools that educate at-risk and lower-income students, some $12 billion for students with special needs. It's a real driver and help for special education. And nearly $30 billion in federal Pell Grants to help low-income students pay for college. So while it is a local initiative for sure, and Common Core has been implemented at the state and local and district level, the Fed still plays a role. To your question, on Secretary Clinton, she's made childcare and early childhood really the key plank of any talk about education. She talks about it a lot. If she's mentioned it at all in debates, it's been about early childhood. She wants to double federal funding for home visit programs like the one she advocated in Arkansas as First Lady. She's talked about increasing the wages of child care workers, a key issue, so there isn't the turnover that they have. It's really plaguing a lot of child care places. She's talked about universal pre-K for four-year-olds and doubling federal funding for early Head Start and Head Start for low-income children. I will point out that she hasn't talked in specifics about how she would pay for these proposals, and the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget and others have estimated that, it could cost up to $500 billion or more for some of these. And a key question is how would she pay for it if she's elected? To Donald Trump, he's talked a little bit, as I said, about issues like the Common Core, but he hasn't talked specifics hardly at all. He's talked a little bit about school choice, but as one source we talked to, and it was a conservative Republican source we talked to, said Donald Trump's policy proposals, quoting here, is like performance art, and you shouldn't read that much into it because he doesn't have much specifics. And there's some frustration there on both sides about that. He has talked a little bit about child care on his website. He talks about the importance of increasing some funding for that. He's proposed making child care costs tax deductible for kids up to 13 years old. Again, like Secretary Clinton, it's not clear how he would pay for all that.
The other interesting aspect of the difference between the two of them, it seems, is that Secretary Clinton is very focused on public education and shoring that system up. And Donald Trump looks like he wants to use the school choice model by giving grants that would, certainly for poorer people, that would be portable, that they could use to choose either public, private, charter, or other options. Is that a fair sort of assessment of that, Eric?
Well, from what we can tell from his proposals, which again lack a lot of specificity, if he were elected president, yes, school choice and portability, a longtime plank of conservatives, to be able to use some monies for parents to, whether it's go to private parochial or charter schools. The plan would involve, I think, some $20 billion government investment, or as the Trump campaign says, reprioritizing existing federal dollars that would go to the states as block grants. But, you know, again, where would the money come from? It would not be new money. So where would he be drawing that some 20-plus billion dollars year? It's a lot of money.
That seems to be a feature of both of the campaigns, a lack of specificity around how one would pay for this if elected. Dean Pianta, you've focused in very striking way on the value and role of pre-K education. You know that Hillary Clinton's running mate, Tim Kaine, when he was governor of Virginia, pressed very hard on this and ran into a wall on the funding, and there just wasn't the money to do that. I wonder if you were advising a next president on this issue, how would you go about advising them on how to find the money for it and the value of finding the money for it?
Right. So, in fact, it's the shortage of money. I think Eric made some good points about the overall federal investment for kids in poverty across the board, and the fact that Clinton's proposal, particularly around universal pre-K, could expand that sum by a considerable amount. I mean, I think she's mostly thinking about paying this through some form of tax credit some dynamic there. Basically, if you look at the current amount of money that's going into the early education system for kids, you can expand a considerable amount. The challenge is going beyond the goal to invest in kids that are at risk. I think once you move to universal, you really expand the total amount that has to be made available to parents. And so the focus is whether you're really looking at this as an opportunity equalizer or kind of a rising tide that floats all the boats across the population.
Well, one hopes we will hear more all the way around. Dean Pianta, I want to thank you for joining us today from the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
We're 22 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. And again, we're wondering today how important the candidates' education platforms are from your perspective. What education issues do you believe the federal government may be able to affect? Because certainly so much of that has devolved to the states, although funding certainly remains in many cases a federal option or a federal approach. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Eric Westerwell, when we get into the sort of the college years, we know that many, many Americans are struggling with college debt and rising tuition. I wonder, as you look at the candidates, where are the differences there? What or do they both struggle with the lack of specificity there as well?
Yeah, I mean, they do. I mean, both candidates talk a little bit about pre-K and a little bit about higher ed. There's this, in my view, a sort of glaring gap, and it's called, K-12 education, and they aren't talking much at all about that. Secretary Clinton, pushed in part by her primary challenge from Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders, has gone and expanded her college plan, and she talks about it a fair amount. I mean, she's free college was a rallying cry for Bernie Sanders, and she has come along and said, folks in this country making an annual income of $125,000 or less, which is some 80% of the nation, they should go to a public college or university tuition free to reduce debt. She's also proposed a moratorium on student debt payments. I think it's a 3-month moratorium, even longer if you are an entrepreneur or involved in launching a company. She's backed efforts to expand universal free community college. So she does have some plans out there. In contrast, Mr. Trump has said very little about higher education, how he would pay for it, how he would improve access and equity.
Has he said much about the debt issue and the number of folks who are sort of struggling with that debt?
Again, it's been vague and really hard to pin down.
Yeah.
We've actually reached out to his surrogates who are, according to the campaign, advising him on education. Both said, you know, we are not authorized to speak about these issues on the record or even on background. It's a bit head scratcher for me and for, I think, many folks. Why would the campaign not want their surrogates talking publicly about the important issue of education? I don't know. You'll have to ask the Trump campaign.
Because you're right. We were just kind of trying to do a little bit of research on this, and the only thing that seems to appear on the question of student loans is a sense that Mr. Trump does not believe that the government should be making money off student loans, and I guess that refers to interest rates and the like, but not a lot of specifics beyond that. And that's very interesting.
Right, and I would ask I would add this, Kathy, that he has an advisor has said, you know, a Trump administration would get the government out of the student loan business and restore lending for higher ed to private banks. And folks we talked to, including, you know, good conservative folks, are saying, you know, that's just not really realistic to have the private sector shoulder all of the lending work. It's just, it's not realistic. It's not going to happen. And we may not be wise to get the government out of the student loan business altogether. It would require a huge shift. It would require complicated planning. And again, the Trump campaign has not offered specifics on how he would do that.
Eric Westervelt joining us today from NPR. You know, it's just intriguing that there hasn't been more focus on education during these debates and during the campaign. And certainly we can have another conversation about what we've been distracted by. But it strikes me, we think about education, this is actually something that affects most Americans one way or the other, whether they have children in school, whether they are served by the products of the school system, whether they have student debt, whether they're trying to afford college, whether they're going back to school. It's just very interesting that this is one of those places where it really does touch people's lives.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, again, the campaign itself, you could argue, hasn't, you know, talked about a number of major issues. It's been caught in somewhat distracting, tawdry debates and character assassinations and other things that lack substance, whether it's foreign policy or education. I think there's a lot of folks saying this campaign so far, in very limited time to turn that around, has lacked substantive discussion of these key issues that the next administration, the next president, whoever he or she will be, is going to have to grapple with.
We're 28 minutes past the hour, and it's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Eric Westervelt with us for just a few more moments. You know, it's a great point. We are now in the waning days of this campaign, so one wonders what we will really begin to see on this issue moving forward. And, of course, all the debates are done, so we'll see whether this is an issue. I know that Donald Trump wants to get rid of the Department of Education at the federal level, if I'm not mistaken about that, or shrinking or eliminating the Department of Education.
Yeah, he's one of a number of Republican candidates in recent decades who have talked about potentially eliminating the federal Department of Education. Donald Trump said, I believe in an interview with Fox News, that he would consider that he would look at closing the Department of Education. But again, it's not clear. As I mentioned earlier, some of these massive programs, whether it's Pell Grants, Title I funding, special education funding, help overseeing, at least encouraging a reevaluation of what testing or assessments are needed at the local level. Who would he have do that?
Right.
Where would the money come from? What would happen to those programs and those massive programs and billions of dollars that are spent?
And very often spent by states, having been authorized to do so. Larry's on the line from Newport News. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I have a lot of student loans, and I'm very concerned about paying them back and everything. But I think if we can prioritize getting the national debt down from, you know, I guess it's like $30 trillion or something, through not, maybe not going to war so much and spending all that money on that, then you know, we'll have more money for education, and that's more of a, for me, that's why that's more of a priority. Who's going to give us, who's going to be sucking all of our resources off for all these wars, unnecessary wars, you know, and then turning around and saying, well, where are we going to get the money? Yeah, you're spending billions of dollars, trillions of dollars on war.
Larry, it's an interesting point, and certainly there are candidates who suggest that we can sort of reshuffle the deck chairs and see what happens. Jill Stein, in fact, doesn't talk as much about using the money that's used to for wars in education, but she points to the $17 trillion she says was spent in the Wall Street bailout and all of the loans and the bailout that were associated with that, and we're talking about $1.3 trillion on student loan debt. So you know, it's an interesting point, but unfortunately, not much conversation about it in this cycle. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it very much. And that's Eric Westervelt. That's also a problem with this too, isn't it? That it's, you know, we say there's not money for things, but then it really depends on how you spend the money once you have it.
It does depend on how you spend the money once you have it. And I would point out that the Obama administration, you know, and the Secretary King, even though he's really only, I believe, going to be in there for 11 months before the end of the Obama administration, he's been pushing ahead with a variety of initiatives on testing, on education funding and equity. He's been doing a lot, and some of it doesn't get a lot of attention, but they, for example, proposed new rules recently that would govern how school districts distribute federal money meant to support, you know, the education of low-income kids, this Title I fund, as I mentioned, you know, to ensure that these federal funds are used, you know, in addition to state and local money and not instead of those funds to help educate the most at-risk low-income students. Because it turned out, once they crunched the numbers, that some districts were spending far more of their Title I funds on their more affluent schools than the ones that really need it. So that's one example where sort of reallocation efforts from the federal government to get the money spent in the right direction to the schools that really need it.
Eric Westervelt, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. You've done so much terrific work on issues that shape education and how it's delivered across America. So I very much appreciate your being with us today from NPR.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Take care. Eric Westervelt is an education correspondent for NPR. He's been walking us through the bottom line, which is that there's not a whole lot of conversation about education underway in the presidential campaign. And again, as we noted a moment ago, it really is something that that affects quite a lot of us. We're glad to have Emily Dury with us today, a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. She covers education there. Emily Dury, thank you for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. We noted earlier in the broadcast that the key differences between what we're able to know of Mr. Trump's proposals and what we're able to know of Secretary Clinton's proposals has to do essentially with a sense that Secretary Clinton would shore up public education and Mr. Trump would offer folks choice in the form of vouchers that they could use for either public or private education. This is those vouchers being primarily for poorer Americans who would then presumably have the money to make those kinds of choices. I wonder, as you've been looking at the candidates and their stances on education, what is most remarkable from your perspective?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that what's interesting about Hillary Clinton especially is that she's walking a really fine line between trying to tie herself to the Obama administration and some of their policies, but then also trying to distance herself. She supports a lot of the same policies, but the Obama administration has clashed with the teachers' unions, especially, who weren't necessarily fond of Secretary Duncan's leadership. And she's been trying to sort of walk a line there and, for instance, to separate testing from teacher evaluations and to say that she's open to reevaluating how we judge teachers, which is something that the NEA has been critical of Obama on. So I think that to me has been sort of fun to watch her try and walk that line on Trump. But I wish I had more of an answer for you. He doesn't talk about education very often. And when he does say things, he sometimes contradicts what he said previously. At one point, he was talking about eliminating the education department entirely. You know, now he's talking about eliminating certain departments, like the Office of Civil Rights, for instance, but maybe not the entire department. It's hard to pin him down on a lot of specifics.
We're at 440-2665-1-800-940-2240. We're talking about the stance of the presidential candidates on education, and we'd love to hear from you today and wonder, to what degree are you concerned about education as a presidential campaign issue? 440-2665-1-800-940-2240 are the numbers where you can join us today. Lance is on the line now from Norfolk. Hi, Lance. You're on the air.
Hi. Good afternoon, Kathy. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Very good discussion. You know, I watched all three debates, and I read the Virginia Pilot, and I like to think I'm somewhat up to date on current events. And when I listen to Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump talk about changes to taxes and to education and their budgets, it was my understanding that those can only those under the jurisdiction of Congress, the House and the Senate. And I thought that Obama and the House and the Senate came to a budget plan for the next 6 to 7 years already. So, you know, how does a listener like me actually find out what really is happening or what powers they really have to, you know, adjust for the annual budget?
Yeah,
actually make changes.
Lance, you've brought up a great question because, you know, very oftentimes when we hear candidates talk about an issue, they're very broad sort of statements, and they're very broad statements. I wonder, Emily Drury, how would you respond to Lance's concern? He says he's pretty well informed, but you know, a lot of this conversation around these issues really is a future-looking approach because a lot of the monies are already committed.
Right, exactly. And very fair question. It's hard to figure out the specifics. And Hillary Clinton, for instance, talks a lot about, you know, quote, making the wealthy pay their fair share and closing tax loopholes to pay for things like universal pre-K. And then Donald Trump will talk about tax credits to help pay for childcare, for instance, or creating a fund to support school choice. But in both cases, it's not necessarily clear where that money would come from. Congress would have to authorize some of it. And then the important thing to remember is that education is really a state and local issue. And yes, there are federal education laws, but a lot of the spending and the allocation of dollars happens at the state and local levels. And so it's important to look at your individual state when you're sort of evaluating the approach you think makes the most sense.
You know, it strikes me as well, there's been a conversation, Mr. Trump has talked about eliminating Common Core, but as I understand it, and this goes to Lance's point, so correct me if I'm wrong, Emily Drury, Common Core was adopted by the state, so there's that would be a state issue at this point, right?
Right, exactly. Donald Trump has repeatedly said he'd get rid of Common Core, and that's been sort of a popular line on the campaign trail, but yeah, not exactly clear how he would do that because those standards were put in place by states. That's not a federal standard. So, difficult for him to make that promise.
We're at 440-2665-1-800-940-2240. Those are the numbers where you can join us today. And we're wondering today where you are on this question of education. Is it something that you care about as you go to the polls? How concerned are you about the presidential candidates' stances on education? We should note again, there will be more than two candidates on the ballot. Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, is a fan of vouchers for public-private school. He would abolish the Department of Education. Jill Stein has been very concerned about student debt. She would guarantee tuition-free education from preschool through the university. And when asked how she would pay for that, she talked about the amount of money that's been spent on bailing out Wall Street and suggests that student debt is a small percentage of that. And so if we reorient the money that's already there, we can take care of student debt. It's a question of priorities. 20 minutes before the hour, 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Emily Jury, on that point, the question around student debt, there's been a very active organization, sort of activist in this regard, saying, look, we're not going to pay our student debt because we think this is appalling and unethical and all the rest of it. And I'm wondering, to what degree are those sorts of protests influencing this campaign when it comes to the student when it comes to the student debt issue? We know that Bernie Sanders was very concerned about that. And this was apparently a plank that made it into the platform because he was so concerned about that.
Right. I don't know how much the protests themselves have influenced the campaign, but no question that Bernie Sanders' campaign moved Hillary Clinton to the left on that issue. And she's come out with this tuition-free college plan for families making less than $125,000. Again, unclear how she would get that through and how she would sort of force states to accommodate that plan. But she's also talked about offering student loan refinancing and even deferment for entrepreneurs to sort of promote innovation. But again, unclear how she would sort of get those through Congress because there's not necessarily agreement on doing that. And then the only thing that we really have from Donald Trump on student loans is that he doesn't support the Education Department handling loans, and he wants the Education Department out of that, but he hasn't necessarily provided an alternative.
Wow. Does that surprise you? I mean, I don't know how long you've been doing this, Emily, but it just strikes me there is precious little detail on this.
This is a weird election year. And as a reporter, it's frustrating, but no, Trump has provided very few details, but that's really across the board. I mean, that's from mm-hmm. pre-K into K-12 and then up through higher ed. And Clinton certainly has provided more details and outlined more of a plan on her website, but we still don't have, there's no guarantee how she would pay for a lot of these things.
Carolyn's on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Carolyn. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
For
go right ahead.
Call.
You're welcome.
Here's my comment. Donald Trump has repeatedly come out against Common Core, saying that the federal government shouldn't have any hand in what should be education that should be handled at the local level. He also, on the other hand, talks about what great things he's going to do for the military. And as someone who knows many military families who move every 18 months, let's say, they might say that having a national standard for education is a good thing, because when they move from one school to the next, their child might be in the gifted program at one school and might be sort of in the middle in the next and might be at the bottom at the next school that they go to. So it seems like there's a bit of a contradiction in his message about things that would help military families, particularly in terms of education.
Carolyn, thank you for the call. And I know that has been a great concern for military families, and certainly this idea of making sure that when students move from one school to the other, that they are able to do that in a more seamless way has been a huge, huge concern. I thank you for the call. Very much appreciate it. 17 minutes before the hour, we're talking with Emily Dury, who is the senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and she covers education. The other thing I was very interested in that you've been looking a lot at, Emily, is the status of colleges that host these debates. And of course, here in Virginia, Longwood University hosted the vice presidential debate. What did you learn about that process? I mean, it certainly does seem like it brings a lot of eyeballs to the college.
It does bring a lot of eyeballs to the college. I think I wasn't aware, or I think a lot of people aren't aware how costly it is. They have to pay the debate commission almost $2 million just for the honor of hosting. And then total cost
Wow. To
around $5 million because the schools are responsible for building everything from the stage to the media risers to handling parking. So it's a costly endeavor. But you see some schools say it's worth it for the attention. And there are even some reports that suggest that applications go up at some of these schools after the schools host the debate.
It's really interesting. We're at 16 minutes before the hour. And the article that you just posted this morning is a very, very interesting one, because it takes a look at this question of student debt. And breaks it down with some very interesting implications. You say Black college graduates are more likely than their white peers to leave schools with student debt, and that now there's a new finding, which is that the gap more than triples just several years after college. What's behind that? What are the factors that are causing that tripling of that gap?
Right. It's pretty surprising. It's a study published by Brookings, but done by a pair of researchers at Columbia University. And they found that a lot of that is actually tied to graduate school, that Black graduates at the undergraduate level are likely to enroll in for-profit graduate schools. There's been a lot of attention paid to for-profits, like Corinthian, mm-hmm. for instance, which shuttered, and some of their predatory practices in terms of encouraging students to enroll in the school, but then not really providing a quality education. We haven't really seen an investigation at the graduate level about how for-profits are acting, but it does make me want to look into how they market to some of these students, because it would seem that if Black graduates are enrolling in these schools at higher percentage than white graduates and then struggling to repay that debt, it would suggest to me that they're not necessarily finding great employment after graduation, when they graduate at all.
Another story for another day. Emily Dury, I want to thank you for the work you're doing on the campaign to let us know who believes what, even though it is a search, an archaeological dig for specificity. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Emily Dury is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and she covers education. We're at 14 minutes before the hour. Linda on the line now from Yorktown. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say, first of all, I am disappointed. You had that big fundraising drive, and I've always given to National Public Radio, but I did not realize how slanted you are democratically. And I'm pro-Trump. I hope he wins. And I completely agree with him that government needs to get out of all these things. They need to get out of social services. They need to get out of education. I happen to work in the school system, and I know that the school systems are now feeding kids. School systems are now providing health care for children in terms of, you know, dental care and mm-hmm. Flu shots and all these things that really parents should be taking care of, and not the school system or social, you know, the education system should not be a social service, basically. Mm. And I know that's an unpopular view, but it's when you only have a certain amount of money, just because you have more checks doesn't mean that you have any, your pot of money has gotten bigger. And there's only a limited amount of money, and it needs to start going to our debt, and it needs to start going to our military and to protect our security of the country. I don't believe in Common Core. We were actually military, and in some places, schools were better than others, but not all things are equal. Mm. And in terms of debt, let's go back to Common Core. Teachers teach to standardization tests, and they're not teaching to children when you have that kind of thing. And in terms of debt, you know, life is not fair. Not everyone is created equal. You know, not everybody should be going to college. And you know, in terms of the for-profit schools, you know, we don't monitor who buys Mercedes-Benz. Okay. You know, do your due diligence. And if you acquire $50,000 in debt during graduate school, or $100,000 or whatever, I mean...
Okay, so Linda, I hear what you're saying. And I'm, you know, I want to go back to your first point, and I want to sort of talk these through little by little. You know, you're right. I mean, there are a lot of these services that are delivered by schools because children are coming to school hungry, and because children don't have steady places to live, because the jobs, many of the jobs that were available before the 2008-7 recession just haven't come back with the kinds of benefits that would allow families, more families, to consistently live in a stable environment that would allow them to keep their children in one school. At least that's what teachers who called this broadcast have said previously, that they are teaching and serving children who come to school because those are the children who are coming to school at the moment. And I hear what you're saying about that might not be what schools should be doing. But boy, it feels like in the short term, would you agree that we sort of have to teach and care for the children that come?
They should be there to teach education. That's what it is, educational system.
All right. And Linda, I want to go back to your earlier point where you said you were surprised that there was, I think you said a more, did you say a Democratic bias?
Oh, yes.
I hope you appreciate that we've been talking for 3 full minutes and you were permitted to say everything that you wanted to say. That's how we do it on this show. So I hope you don't feel short-shrifted in that regard. That certainly would not be our intention. But it occurs to me that, and I've really seen this over this election cycle and since the development of more issue-based news programming, more ideology-based news programming, is that very often what is balance is perceived to be more slanted one way or the other. And it just occurs to me, I've noticed this since we have more ideologically based news, that sometimes it may feel like that, but it's actually just balance. Does that make sense?
In terms of letting me speak, absolutely. However, I've been listening. I work about 40 minutes from where I live, and so I listen to your program all the time. And at first, I really thought it was me. I'm like, what the heck? All these news programs are like more pro-Hillary than they are Trump, and I couldn't believe it.
I think you've hit on something right there. I don't think that any of these broadcasts are intended to be pro-Hillary or pro-Trump or pro-Stein or pro-Johnson. I think the issue is really to talk about the issues, which is what we've certainly been trying to do, and exploring those issues and looking at where the candidates are on it. And the fact of the matter is there are not a whole lot of specifics. So that's what we're trying to explore. And I hope you feel like you were treated well, Linda. I thank you for the call. And I'm sorry I have to run because Dave Ress, we've kept Dave Ress on hold from the Daily Press since about 12:45. He's kind enough to join us because there's another wrinkle to this as well that we have alluded to for the last hour or so. And it has to do with this relationship between the federal government and state government. Dave Ress, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Kathy. Always happy to be here.
This is interesting because, and especially true when we talk about education, there are so many of these issues that we have to sort of understand what's a federal government responsibility, what's a state responsibility. And as we talk about those monies that come down to the state, some very interesting things have happened in the Commonwealth of Virginia and many other states as well, with regard to the impact of the recession about which we just spoke.
Yes, yes, indeed. It's interesting, and it was fascinating to listen to Linda. There's a very funny thing about education is that politicians love to talk about it, and they don't tend to get down into the weeds. So the federal role in education is meant to sort of, give priority to particular programs, and so particularly for the K-12, the stuff that we really worry about with our kids and getting them off to a good start, a lot of the rhetoric tends to be kind of vague. There've been a couple of exceptions. We always get struck by efforts like Senator Tim Kaine, who has pushed very hard on career and technical education funding in the Senate. And Bobby Scott, I know both are Democrats, so perhaps not everyone knows about some of the nitty gritty they do. But Representative Scott works quite hard at using criminal justice funding to deal with at risk children who might be dropping out of school and heading towards paths that nobody wants them to head down. But it's odd and kind of disturbing sometimes how little specificity mm-hmm. there is with K-12 education and early childhood education when particularly on the federal front, people talk about being big supporters of education.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is a very interesting thing. I was just struck in preparing for this broadcast that really is the case. There is very little specificity on so many of these issues. We should note as well that when we talk about money for the states and what the states distribute, that has really changed in terms of what's coming to the localities and what's coming in terms of state revenues for per pupil aid.
That's true, and it's actually one reason why I was happy to hold and listen to Linda's comments, because I think the concerns that she expresses that many people here do share sometimes lead us to forget that there's basically something in our state constitution that has since 1972, I think, committed us to saying our fundamental policy in this state is to try to get everyone off to an equal start in school. And of course, you know, we're all quite different. Children come from different, you know, have different needs and abilities when they get into school. And so a fundamental part of what we try to do with what the state does with education is to try to say, you know, everyone gets a fair crack at getting off to a good start in life. And that's where some of what I think we've seen since the recession in Virginia is an issue that I think we probably ought to be paying some attention to. Generally speaking, what the state contributes to the cost of education on a per pupil basis is down, but it's also down in kind of disproportionate ways. There are places like Newport News and Hampton over on this side, unfortunately Norfolk and Virginia Beach on the south side, that have really seen very sharp drops in what the state contributes on a per pupil basis. Where there are places up in Northern Virginia, some of the wealthier suburbs of Washington, where it's actually gone up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's hard not to look at that and say, gee, is that really, what's driving that? Is it really a question of what some of the specific things that we know children specifically need? Things like, you know, reading readiness, so that you're reading at third grade level, algebra, pre-K. And it's kind of hard to avoid the feeling that a lot of what drives how we fund education in this state, the state's share of education, isn't really factoring in things like the depth of need for specific things like learning to read, doing math.
Really, really interesting. Dave Ress, it's always good to talk with you, and I thank you for recalling us to the state's constitution, which gets at this issue of an equal start. In fact, it says the General Assembly shall provide for a system of free public elementary and secondary schools for all children of school age, and shall seek to ensure that an educational program of high quality is established and continually maintained. So the Constitution is probably a good thing to look at now and again, I suspect.
I agree.
Dave Ress, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for your thoughtful comments and for the work you do to put these issues in perspective for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kathy.
You
bet. Good.
Dave Ress on the line now from the Daily, or on the line just now from the Daily Press. Our thanks to Emily Dury from the Atlantic as well, and Bob Pianta, the Dean of the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. And our thanks to Eric Westervelt for joining us as the NPR correspondent. I keep saying the NPR. It's actually more than one. An NPR correspondent in education. So thanks for your calls today as well. Coming up next on 89.5, it's Making Contact. And then tonight on WHRO TV 15, we've got a doubleheader of the Antiques Roadshow. It's the Boomer Years Vintage. You know, I do not like things from the 50s being called vintage. At mid-century, much better. Vintage treasures from the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, including Elvis's Love Me Tender standee, are appreciated by the good folks at the Antiques Roadshow. So my guess is that's going to be a great show. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.